really struggled with a decision because I was going to go tell my friends I'm going to build a supersonic jet.
What made you think you could actually do it?
Well, I didn't think I could do it. One of my premises is that the only way I could find my limits was to pick the most motivating thing in the world and just give it everything I've got and see how far I could get. One of the things that really surprised me is like how easy it actually is to skate to the frontiers of human knowledge.
This is the Stubbornly Young podcast for people in their 50s, 60s, and beyond who are engaged in the world and want to remain relevant to the younger people in their lives. You may know that for 5 years before Stubbornly Young, I've been doing a podcast called Proco 360, featuring highly successful Colorado entrepreneurs. Recently for Proco 360, I did a session with Denver Ventures featuring three entrepreneurs and a live audience. One of those entrepreneurs was Blake Scholl, founder and CEO of Boom Supersonic, the startup company that has raised about $700 million to create the first supersonic jet since the failed Concorde. That was what, back in the 70s? Anyway, Blake okayed me to use his portion of the interview to share with you. Boom Supersonic is getting a ton of press because its prototype flight worked, and they're now building a production facility to make supersonic jets. Hey, with no background in aerospace engineering, Blake's decision to start Boom Supersonic is really crazy. And I'm sharing this conversation with you because it's a hot topic and because Blake is such an interesting guy. You're going to want to talk about Boom Supersonic with the younger people in your life. So here we go. Blake Scholl's with Boom Supersonic. All right, we're starting every interview with the origin story. We're going to do that. I know you've told it before. I think it'll be great to ground us in that. And I've got so many questions for you. Fire away.
So if anybody doesn't know the company, we're building supersonic passenger jets. And I do not have the resume at all for this. I went to school for computer science and I went to Amazon in 2001 when my family was like, hey, we got you a computer science degree. Why are you working at a bookstore?
It happens a lot these days.
But flight's been my passion basically as long as I can remember. I started flying for fun in college, and in my 20s, I was up in Seattle. And of course, there's one of the Concords in the Seattle Museum of Flight. And I went on it and I kind of remember thinking, like, why is the most amazing airplane ever made in a museum when there's nothing better in the sky? And so I set a lifetime goal of flying supersonic. I put a Google alert on supersonic jet, and I figured, like, I just want to be first to know when I could buy a ticket. And a decade went by, and it was basically crickets. There was no credible effort to pick up where Concorde left off and to build anything better. And meanwhile, I'd had my Amazon career. I had been part of a couple different startups that had basically failed. Including, you know, one that was a company I sold to Groupon that made a barcode scanning game. When I was doing that first company, I would like wake up in the morning and think like, why am I doing this? Like if I like stack rank the most important thing in the world to the least important, I have to go get a backhoe and like dig a hole to find where like barcode scanning game would live. And yet like, we all know what it's like to be an entrepreneur, right? Like it's like chewing glass. And like just because I knew mobile and e-commerce and, you know, I should be able to build this app, it didn't make it like any easier. And so when I had a chance to like really acquihire the company over to Groupon and like, you know, rest and vest for a couple of years, it was like my escape fantasy come real. And I went to like one rung up the ladder from like barcode scanning game to internet coupon. We know how it is. The founding bug had bit me. I wanted to found again, but I never ever wanted to get up in the morning and think, why did I do this? And is it worth the pain? And what I realized was, I think is the difficulty level in a startup is not set by the business. It's actually set by the founder, because I think we all have where our red lines are. And I know for me, I'm going to run at my red line no matter what I'm doing. But I can choose, there's almost like a money ball. I can choose to work on something more inspiring, and then it could be worth being at my red line versus another, you know, random software thing. So I started organizing all my ideas by how happy I would be if it worked. And I
it's kind of brilliant.
Well, it worked out all right, and at least so far. But so basically, that the concept was like, let me just optimize for my own motivation. And for me, anything with an airplane in it went to the top of the list. And I thought I would have to, you know, I thought I would get 2 weeks into the research on supersonic and, you know, understand why it was a terrible idea that nobody else was pursuing. And then I'd move on, you know, confidently to the next thing. And I'd never have to worry about like being 80 and think like, what if I'd had the courage to look at the supersonic thing? So, long story short, what I expected to find like very obvious reasons that it was a terrible idea. What I instead found was that the internet was full of conventional wisdom about why you couldn't have high-speed flight that did not stand up to basic analysis that anybody with a spreadsheet, a web browser, and half a brain could do. And so I ended up spending a year basically learning aerospace engineering. And then kind of felt like, I don't really understand how it is that I'm the human with this idea. But either I have no courage or I'm going to give it a run. And that was, it's about 10 years ago that we hired our first people.
Wow. So I learned how to drive a boat on YouTube. I haven't seen any how to design a supersonic jet videos on YouTube. So seriously, like, and I think this is important for everybody in the room. Like, what made you think you could actually do it?
I didn't think I could do it. One of my premises is that the only way I could find my limits was to pick the most motivating thing in the world and just give it everything I've got and see how far I could get. And I sort of didn't expect to get nearly as far as we've actually gotten.
If you had to think back on that day you decided you wanted to try it because it was the most motivating thing you could think of, what percentage odds of success would you have given yourself?
It was very low. I don't know. It was probably like epsilon more than zero. I really struggled with the decision because I was going to go tell my friends I'm going to build a supersonic jet, and it's like you could just like watch the eyes roll back.
You put an aluminum foil hat on,
right? Like one of my closest friends said, "All right, Blake, like, you call me back when you got something less pie in the sky." And I remember for a while, the project code name was Pie because the goal was to get the pie in the sky. But it was, you know, like, it was very, like, I have this very complicated relationship with my own ego on this. And I remember thinking about the entrepreneurs I really admire. And in particular, I thought of Bill Gates. And Gates, I think in the 70s, had said that his goal was to put a computer on every desk and in every home running Microsoft software. And he said that in the 70s, right? And then he did that and a bunch of things well beyond that. Gates didn't have the resume to do it. Heck, he didn't even have a resume. And yet he had the courage to go make that declaration. What was it like to be Bill Gates? Like, he had to be willing to throw himself into something big. Well, in his heart of hearts, he knew it was nowhere close to guaranteed. And so they're like, when the people who like take on big missions and succeed, like, we know their names. You know, it's Gates and it's Jobs, and back in the day it's Thomas Edison. You know, the greats of the great. And I think there's also like a dark matter of founders. And they're the people who take on big things and for whatever reason it doesn't work. And I sort of made the conscious decision that I would much rather be a dark matter entrepreneur than I didn't try entrepreneur.
Wow.
So everyone must have said you're crazy who knew what you were doing, right? Everyone did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mostly. I mean, there was one guy you told me to go for it.
Who was that?
Avichal Garg. He's sort of well known now because he started Electric Capital. This is before he had started Electric. And I remember he had just sold a company to Facebook. We were like hanging out at the Facebook like cafeteria. I told him the idea and why I thought it could work. And he says, "Blake, you just need to go do this. It makes sense." And years later, he told me he thought I was completely crazy, but he could tell I was so excited. He just didn't have it in his heart to tell me not to do it.
Oh, God, how funny. Well, now you've raised about $700 million. Is that roughly an accurate number?
Six to seven, somewhere in that range.
Somewhere in that range, right.
I've lost count a little bit.
A guy who does what you do should be able to keep track, but that's
oops.
All right. Yeah. So what did you tell investors? Like, I'm going to build a supersonic jet. I've never done it. I don't know how. And I hope it works. Like, how does that pitch go?
Not like that wouldn't have gone well. People often ask me, like, how do I have any credibility in the space? And I think there's no substitute for actually knowing what you're talking about. And so, like, I spent a year learning it for myself. And a thing I've come to believe is, like, great people don't hire experts and delegate. Great people find experts and use the experts as teachers. And so the first thing I did was I built a spreadsheet model of airline economics. So I actually had looked at starting an airline, and so I understood the fundamental drivers of airline economics. And then, you know, I was like, okay, I got to look at supersonic. Okay, so great. So I went all the way back. I took remedial calculus and physics because I hadn't had any since high school. I bought every aerospace textbook I could find. I read them. If I couldn't understand it, I threw it out, got a different one. Took an airplane design. I mean, there's just no substitute for getting to enough knowledge that when someone asks a question, like, I confidently know the answer.
So do you think in a year you were maybe one of the world's foremost experts on supersonic flight? I mean, that's what it sounds like. You crammed into it.
It's
yeah.
It's kind of a mind fuck to say that. Sorry, can I say that here? But it's one of the things that really surprised me is, like, how easy it actually is to skate to the frontiers of human knowledge. Like, we tend to get taught that, like, the big important things in the world have, like, great people who are on them and have studied them for years and have 15 PhDs. But it's actually, like, shockingly easy to discover the things that all the quote-unquote experts have missed. Like, it took 2 weeks to have the key idea. The key idea is, if you beat Concorde by about 10% in fuel economy, you can make a supersonic seat with the economics of a flatbed in business class, but the flight's so fast you don't need the bed. That's the idea. That's it. Somehow no one else had found that.
Wow. Now, one thing that the audacity of the amount of money that it takes to actually try this before you even know it's going to work, in most, you know, most entrepreneurs in the room, most people we talk about, you know, they've got a minimal viable product that costs thousands or maybe six figures or, you know, but you have to build a jet that flies before that's your minimum viable product, right?
Yeah, this is why pre-orders matter.
This is why what?
Pre-orders matter.
Pre-orders, yes.
Right? Like the, you know, you can kind of sort of think about businesses in along two axes. Like, one is, like, how much capital does it require to try the idea? And the other axis is, like, how obviously a good idea is it? And the vast majority of successful, like, you know, internet companies, the companies been created over the last few decades in tech, are clustered in the not very obviously a good idea, but also really cheap to try. Like open an app on your phone and summon a stranger from the internet to give you a ride, right? Like, not obviously a good idea, but really cheap to try. eBay, I think, is also the category.
Like, Airbnb, lots of, let's put a mattress
Airbnb,
in our bed. Yeah.
Right? It's invite strangers from the internet to sleep on your couch. Like, this doesn't sound like a good idea, but it's cheap to try. So supersonic jets, I think, is in this category of it's actually not that hard to make it really obvious that it's a good idea. I think at a certain level, like, intuitively, we all want faster flights. But Concorde missed on product market fit. $20,000 ticket, 100 uncomfortable seats. You can't fill the seats. It doesn't fit the airline economic model at all, especially not in the 1970s. So what we had to go do is find a capital light way to prove that if we built what we set out to build, that there was definitely a large market for it. Getting LOIs early mattered, getting United to make a deposit mattered, getting American to make a deposit mattered.
So what kind of deposits? Are these deposit sizes big enough that they're important for you, but small enough that the risk for these companies is, like, not that big of a deal?
Basically.
Yeah.
You sort of have to find there's, like, some sort of Venn diagram, right? Of, like, deals that are useful to us and, like, deals the counterparty will do. And then you have to find the overlap and do the deal, right?
Yeah.
The most surprising thing in all of this was that like airlines would actually do these deals before we'd ever flown anything.
Wow. All right. So is there some secret sauce that, in the presentation that you found resonated with them?
We got to find the right customer at the right time in their history. So timing mattered. Like the very first one we did was Virgin. And there's a whole story of like how I got to Branson. But I got to Branson and kind of told him what we were doing and why. Yeah, this is what we were, this is like during Y Combinator. And like, I was like trying to get some kind of a deal done before demo day. And he sort of leans back in his chair and he's like, oh guys, this is like brilliant. Like, I love it. But like, I'm already doing like one of these things with Virgin Galactic. And I don't know if I could like do two. I said, Richard, I'm not asking for your money. I'm asking, when this works, would you like the first 10 to have a Virgin logo on the tail, not a British Airways logo? Because if you'll raise your hand and say, this makes sense and I want it, I'll get all the money somewhere else. I don't need a penny from you. And you know, if you know anything about Branson, like you know his like favorite thing is to stick it to BA. So we let William stick it to BA, and the deal got done on an email.
Wow! So that was really what he was buying, was sticking it to British Airways in a way.
Right. So sometimes there's like a very strange way to package what we're selling to turn it to the thing that the other party wants. Like, so the next deal we did was Japan Airlines. And basically, we sold Japan Airlines insurance against our own success. Okay, what does that mean? We went to them and basically said, okay, what percentage of your business comes from business class? And they're like, well, it's only 20% of seats, but it's like half the revenue and about 80% the op profit. Okay, you guys know those passengers. Do you think they'd switch airlines for flights twice as fast? And they're like, oh yeah. Yeah, totally they would. Like obviously they would. Okay, well, what would happen to your business if ANA had this and you didn't? And they're like, oh, shit. Like, we wouldn't just lose our international business, like, because people switch all their other domestic flying too, and we'd have to become like a low-cost airline. We'd be lucky to survive that. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, sign here, you do it to them.
Last question for you, which is that there was a time when you had 3 weeks cash left. Regardless of what Richard Branson did and all that stuff, you had 3 weeks of cash left. Can you tell a story about how you got through that?
Well, there was 2 more weeks before we got any more money.
Ah, one week.
We got into 7 days of cash. I don't recommend this. I kept telling the team at the time that there are some things that are more fun to tell stories about later than they are to live through. And so here we go. I should tell the story, I guess. Things had taken longer than we wanted to get to key milestones. The market sucked. And like every attempt we'd made to go like raise around had basically failed. And I remember calling, I called Paul Graham when we were at 3 weeks. I said, Paul, we've got 3 weeks of cash. I need some advice. And a whole series of things happened, but basically PG saved the company. It was part of a group of people who managed to put what ended up being a very successful round together. And we ended up raising $150 million of fresh capital, put a whole bunch of runway back on the balance sheet. I don't recommend that.
I bet that felt good though, seeing that $150 in the bank.
It felt a little better. Yeah. Yeah. It got done right as we broke the sound barrier, and then like all kinds of things happened. Yeah.
Wow. And too bad you couldn't celebrate with a loud boom.
Right. Like I wanted to call it the boom heard around the world, but it was actually the boom heard by nobody.
Yeah. I mean, that's really one of your improvements, is that your planes do not create a sonic boom.
Yeah. That was actually not the original plan. We had, our original plan had been, we're going to fly supersonic over water, subsonic over land, like solve the sonic boom thing another day. And yet there's this like well-known physics that people have talked about for a long time called Mach cutoff, which basically like if you it's really software. If you fly the airplane at the right speed and altitude for the day, the boom will never reach the ground. But we looked at it when we were buying other people's engines, and it basically just didn't work. The engines weren't powerful enough to do it. And so we kind of shelved the idea. And meanwhile, like, we had this like famous breakup with Rolls-Royce. We started building our own engines, started optimizing our own engines. And I go to the engineering status meetings, and it was like, oh, transonic performance keeps getting better. And we're like, huh, that's interesting. And then we did our first supersonic flight. And sort of by happenstance, we did it in the boomless condition without really trying. And I'm on Twitter, and like the whole internet is like, well, the whole reason this company exists is this all sonic boom. And I like couldn't convince people that was actually not the whole point. Yeah. And then I was thinking, wait a minute, the engine numbers just keep getting better. So I called an emergency engineering meeting on a Saturday. And I was like, guys, we got to rerun the math. Because with the new engines, can we actually fly in boomless condition? And it took about 90 minutes. And they're like, yeah, it actually just works.
Talk about this notion of ambitious vision versus fantasy, maybe.
I'll say a couple of things. I think one of the biggest mistakes made by smart people is to not notice when context changes. And so I try to hold a lot of awareness for myself. I try to teach the team to like remember where our conclusions came from. Because if something, like, think of it as like a big complex spreadsheet. And if like someone changes the assumption in cell A1, do you like remember to refresh all the other cells? And like the story I was telling about Boomlist for us was like this. It was like we discovered in early February that like we'd stumbled across a solution for Sonic Boom that was practical. And we like completely changed the strategy of the company. And everyone thought we'd planned it that way. And just, I think you just have to notice, you have to know where your origin story really came from. And if something in the assumptions changes, then you can totally like embrace it and you can notice it quickly.
Has your initial vision changed as you've matured in the company's development, the company's growth?
It's sort of complicated for us because we have, like, our direct customers are airlines, but it's always been my view that our real customers are passengers. And it's a very different view than you get out of like a Boeing. And so, you know, we deliberately stay very close to passengers, and we try to listen to the airlines in the right way. Because some airlines really understand the passengers and some like, oh boy.
Not naming them though, right? No.
No, I can't name them. It would be way more fun. But yeah, so we try to sort of, with airlines, we try to say, what do they know that we don't know that we need to learn? And it's that same sort of idea of don't delegate to experts, learn from experts.
All right, question, your name and your question, please.
Yeah, my name is Charlie, and thank you guys all for being here. Blake, my question's for you. No pun intended, but how do you sort of stay grounded, right? You've raised a lot of money from prominent investors, have a lot of media coverage. What you're building sort of speaks to the ability of U.S. engineering. So when you sort of look forward of build what you're building, how do you just stay grounded and stay focused on the mission?
I think this is going to sound really obvious. Like just come to the office every day and see all the freaking problems we have to solve and work on them. Like there is a mountain of hard work to be done, and I enjoy working on it with the team.
Okay, that's it for episode 21 of the Stubbornly Young podcast for people in their 50s, 60s, and beyond who want to remain engaged in the world and relevant to the younger people in their lives. I was so excited to share my conversation with Blake Scholl of Boom Supersonic with you. I hope it inspired you to talk about bold visions and crazy aspirations. I'm Dave Tabor. If you've got friends and family who are stubbornly young, please recommend that they give this podcast a listen. And if you've got ideas for episodes and content, let me know at dave@stubbornlyyoung.com. Glad you've joined me on this journey.